Welcome to the first of the Back Talk series. I'm going to be your host. My name is Janet Roach. I'm going to run you through what we're going to try to do today, and then I've got a couple of opening remarks, and we're going to go through the different types of programs. So welcome to Trauma Informed Design, with a little special twist about education, about K through 12. First, I want to thank Mahesh and the Board of Trustees, and Don Hunsaker, Eliza, the Alumni Council, and Kristen Hansen for making this all work. And of course, I could not have done this without the DHH, which is Design for Human Health program at the BAC, without Davis Hart. We've worked really hard to get you a really great program today. Again, my name is Janet Roach of Janet Roach Designs. I would like to think that was quite inspired. And I'm also on the Alumni Council, and I am the class of 2016. I'm also a BAC instructor. I'll be your host today. And also what we are doing today is that we are recording live for the first time for my podcast, which is called Inclusive Designers. And we will have a whole bunch of, we'll have this recording, both audio and also visual, up for the first time on our website, which is inclusivedesigners.com. Also, what we always do at our website is put down references and resources for you to go back to and look at, so that you can help your own clients. So with that, I have to read my notes, otherwise I will go completely off script and it will take way too long. So I just wanted to start off by acknowledging the fact that, you know, we live in very unusual times of great stress and really trauma, and kids aren't just affected by the pandemic and now the subsequent violence and protests and all the visuals that we're seeing with that. It's been hard for everybody. Today I saw an article that was talking about Mount Sinai, and Mount Sinai is a hospital, and they've created some calming and safe spaces using various images of biophilia to help re-regulate the medical personnel that are going through so much. So even though we go and we joke a lot about things like the she shed and a man cave, we all really need places to re-regulate ourselves, right? And whether it's just a room in your house and you call it the she shed, or you call it the man cave or whatever. So with that, I'd like you to also think, when we go through this program, I'd like you to think about the fact that, you know, you could be doing a lot of different things for also your employees, right? And it doesn't just have to be K through 12. We're also talking about higher education. We're talking about the BAC. We're talking about all the other schools out there, as well as workplaces. And how can we do that to make things better for everybody and help people to feel safer and calmer and be able to kind of re-regulate themselves? And I would be kind of remiss that it was interesting when we started first putting out this program, we knew we needed to talk about social inequities. And it was just, that was 3 weeks ago. And I kept thinking to myself, how are we going to kind of put that into the component? Because it's such an important part. But on the flip side, we have so much information to get to, and we were afraid that we were going to kind of run out of time. But lo and behold, here came all these, you know, protests and stuff like that. So we have a great platform for you today to talk about that. So what we're going to do is I'm going to introduce you to Mary Jo Cooper, who's going to be my co-host today. For those of you who listen to my podcast, you'll recognize her. She's already been a guest, as has Davis. Davis will be presenting a little bit later, but Mary Jo is going to help me walk through everybody's presentation and what we're kind of going to be looking at. Before we begin, I just want to talk about two things real quick, and I think they're important. As first things first, I mean, right now I'm seeing a little sign in front of me, in front of my face, that says Eliza Wilson has requested you to turn off your webcam. So there's been some technical difficulties. You know, we're just going to try to be kind to ourselves and realize that we're kind of all in this together, and we're trying to all figure it out. And that also includes these types of platforms, right? So there's that. And then also, I don't know if you've kind of noticed, I'm a little anxious. This is our first time on video. We usually do this, obviously just audio, because it's usually podcast format. And I've had quite a bit of coffee today. So I'm going to start off what we're going to offer to you, whether or not you would like to stand, because it's 3 o'clock and some of you probably have been here all day. If you would like to stand, take a moment and breathe a little bit. Take a breath in through the nose and out through the mouth. Do it a couple of times. You can do it with me. Okay, ready? In through the nose. Out through the mouth. In through the nose. Out through the mouth. In through the nose. Out through the mouth. Little things like that can make a big difference in everybody's lives. So anyways, so that's my intro, and I'm going to start off and introduce Mary Jo Cooper.
Hi, Mary Jo. Can you tell us a little bit about who you are?
I'm the Vice President of Long-Term Support Services at Bay Cove Human Services, which is a multi-service agency in Boston, human service agency. I oversee programs for people with developmental and intellectual disabilities, residential day, family support, individual supports, that sort of stuff, community-based programs.
Very nice. Terrific. So what we've decided to do today, right, Mary Jo, is that you and I are going to talk a little bit about what we're going to go see, what kind of videos. Some of them are videotaped. Some of them are going to go live. And you're going to go and introduce everybody. Why don't you give us a little overview?
So Christine is going to talk about trauma and just sort of the basic principles. Angela then is going to talk about sort of the overview in terms of communities in from policy standards and from a school, she's a school psychologist, so from that standpoint as well. Davis is going to be our academic, our real academic, with a lot of theory that's evidence-based that kind of pulls everything together. And then Sophia's going to talk about actual putting everything, kind of the theoretical pieces that everybody's talked about so far, into practice at McCormick School in Boston.
So Mary Jo, let's kick it off. Who do we
Christine.
Have first?
And Christine's going to talk about trauma, basic trauma. Christine is the Senior Policy Analyst for Trauma Informed Consultant. She's the owner of Cowart Trauma Informed Partnerships, and she can be reached at Christine@COTIPUSA.com. So Christine.
Christine, take it away.
Hello. My name is Christine Cowart, and I'm going to talk about what trauma is and why it matters, especially in relation to design. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration defines trauma as having 3 parts. An experience that happens to an individual. The individual has to believe that it is physically or emotionally harmful or life-threatening, and it has to have lasting negative effects on the individual throughout time. In 1998, a medical practice in California noticed that some of their patients were doing significantly better than others with seemingly similar backgrounds. They identified 10 common characteristics that when experienced as a child could result in poorer health outcomes. We refer to these as adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs for short. ACEs can have lasting negative impacts throughout a person's life, including increased injury, effects on mental and maternal health, increased infections and chronic disease, the adoption of risky behaviors, and loss of opportunities. I want to stress that this is risk, not certainty. There are a lot of things that can impact how a person is affected by adversity, including exercise, life choices, personal relationships, and therapy. But as you can see from this list, the effects of these experiences is not just psychological. Having experienced adversity can quite clearly affect a person's physical health dramatically. This data shows the prevalence of ACEs across our nation, but it's based on information collected through telephone surveys and is believed to be significantly underreported. Evidence indicates that at least 78% of the U.S. population has experienced at least one traumatic event in their lifetimes. As we know from the definition of trauma, ACEs do not come close to encompassing all forms of trauma. The recognition that trauma can be caused by more than personal events resulted in the concept of adverse community environments. So let's talk about our current situation. We're all experiencing isolation, which can magnify depression and lead to suicidal ideation. We're all more confined. Kids might be confined to unsafe homes and not have interaction with others who could intervene. Most of the interaction kids are currently getting is coming through screens, which means they're much more likely to see the really disturbing images and videos of current events, including police violence and the resulting unrest and protests. Kids are feeling out of control and may not have anyone with whom to process these feelings or what they're seeing. Kids are feeling loss, both concrete and ambiguous, which is harder to define and harder to ask for help about. We all experience stress in our lives. If I do the same thing over and over again and never change it up, I'm feeling comfortable, but I'm also not learning anything. This is my comfort zone. In order to learn something new, I have to step outside my comfort zone. When I can do this with a feeling of relative safety, that's positive stress. This is where learning happens. When those boundaries get pushed even more, I get nervous, my heart starts racing, and in my case, I get blinders or tunnel vision. I feel really uncomfortable and as though things might end quite badly. But if it's a relatively short-lived experience, or if I have someone to process the event with, it might be okay. This is tolerable stress. But when those boundaries get pushed even further to a place where I seriously feel as though I can't handle it, and there's no end in sight, or I feel as though my life may be in danger, and I have no one to process it with, that's toxic stress. Toxic stress is the mechanism by which adversity becomes traumatic. Two people might experience the same thing, and it might be traumatic to one and not to the other. Genetics has something to do with this, because people have certain genetic makeups that protect them from anxiety or depression. Very frequently, however, the difference is whether the person has a supportive adult to rely on to buffer the person from what would otherwise be traumatic. Toxic stress activates your fight, flight, or freeze response. When this happens repeatedly over time, changes occur in your brain that result in an exaggerated stress response to situations that can lead to hyperarousal, hypervigilance, increased wakefulness, and sleep disruption. In addition to changes within the brain, experiencing toxic stress can result in other physical changes to one's body. This image shows just some of these physical impacts. There are things that can make a person who's experienced trauma feel as though it's happening again in the present reality. These are referred to as triggers. Common triggers include unpredictability, sensory overload, feeling vulnerable or frustrated, confrontation, or experiencing something that reminds them of the trauma that originally occurred. We talked about the possible impacts of trauma and mentioned that just because a person experienced something does not mean they'll experience the negative outcomes or risks associated with that event. Resilience is a person's ability to overcome serious hardship. And the number one way to protect against the risks associated with trauma. Trauma-informed design is about integrating the principles of trauma-informed care into design with the goal of creating physical spaces that promote safety, well-being, and healing. This requires realizing how the physical environment affects identity, worth, and dignity, and how it promotes empowerment. Environments have the ability to increase or reduce our stress. By anticipating and mitigating potential triggers, you can create spaces in which children's stress systems can rest and they can find peace. In this peace, they can form supportive relationships with adults, adults who can challenge them and support them through learning, which happens in the positive stress zone. This will not only improve their academic learning, but will help build their resilience over time. Trauma-informed design gives you the opportunity to minimize potential triggers and calm the stress responses of people who use the space. This can buffer their experiences and build their resilience, giving them a previously elusive sense of physical and emotional safety. But what an amazing gift that would be.
Christine, you're so incredible about being able to just condense everything in an incredible way to make everything just very accessible and very understandable. We're going to throw in a little poll. So how likely are you to mention trauma-informed design in the next 6 months? So if you get a chance and you'd like to hit it, it could be not at all, somewhat, likely, mostly, definitely. My guess is right now you're starting to think about it, and because that's also why you're here, right? Can we get Mary Jo back up on the screen, Eliza, please? Hi, Mary Jo. Thanks for coming back. Mary Jo, listen, so what were your takeaways from that? And Christine should be joining us too.
So I think, actually, it was great, Christine. Thank you. The takeaways for me were that the ACEs, or the adverse childhood experiences, are really impacted by social determinants of health. In particular, for me, the takeaway was around the social cohesion and social context, and economic, obviously. So poverty, housing, and food insecurities kind of were what was coming to my mind. And then given a pandemic, health would be, and health access could really impact a child's resilience and response to trauma in these.
Absolutely.
So that was kind of my.
In these times, sure. Yeah, Christine, is there anything you'd like to add, that anything that you would think that the audience needs to hear, or you'd want to magnify or shout from the rooftops?
By all means, the number one way to build a person's resilience is strengthening relationships. And that happens in the best of times through supportive adults being in people's lives, both children and other adults, and having positive experiences with them. The whole point of trauma-informed design is so that it can happen in a safe environment, because people can't learn when they're not feeling safe. People can't have those positive experiences if they're worried about something impacting them, either physically or emotionally. So it all goes hand in hand.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Christine. We'll bring you back at the end and we'll have a little group conversation. Mary Jo, who's up?
So Angela Christiani is a school psychologist and a political strategist, which kind of pulls together some really cool pieces of this.
Really great elements, right? Yeah. So Angela's going to go live. So Eliza?
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me? I hope everyone's well. It's my pleasure to be here today, working as a school psychologist in the city of Boston in the McCormick School, which you've spoken about today, as a political director on behalf of teachers across the city of Boston. And I'm not sure if I'm getting a back echo here.
Well, like we said, there's been some technical difficulties. It's all good. We're just trying to get through this together.
When I was political director, I had the blessing to be able to move policy related to safe and supportive schools. So that's the framework in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that embraces bullying, truancy, safe and supportive schools. It's a grant program, public behavioral health, turnaround schools, trauma-sensitive schools, guidelines around emotional learning. Sorry, it's not working. not working to get this on.
All right, we're going to skip to the next presenter, and then we'll come back to Angela.
I was just going to say, let's work out those kinks and let's keep moving on. So Mary Jo,
yeah.
I think we're going to introduce Davis, right? And Davis actually has a film presentation. So that should be smooth and we can be able to move on from there. Sound like a plan?
Yep. People may know that Davis Hart is the thesis and faculty program advisor at the BAC. She's a health advocate and speaker. She is very well known in the field, and we are delighted that she's able to join us here. Davis?
All right, roll Davis.
Hi everyone, I'm Davis. I'm going to provide you some examples and some resources of what we know about trauma-informed design in K-12 settings from before the pandemic. As is quite obvious, I would imagine you all know how much more urgent applying trauma-informed design is moving forward. And let's listen to one young person read these two quotes from the slide now.
Children's talent to endure stems from their ignorance of alternatives. By the poet Maya Angelou. Veo al final de mi rudo camino que yo fui el arquitecto de mi propio destino. I see at the end of my rough journey that I've been the architect of my own destiny. By the poet Amado Nervo.
Here's another version of the three realms of ACEs to remind the non-trauma-informed people. Adverse childhood experiences is what the ACEs stands for. The converse of this idea is the opportunity for resilience and re-regulation. We can see that substandard schools and even the schools that are well-designed may very well have room for improvement and increase their trauma-informed design nature. But clearly, this is a big ecological system with many layers. So let's move on to talking more about the schooling trauma-informed design relationship. Being a design researcher, this question I have on the slide is actually a couple years old. Can design buffer children's stress? Well, I'd say the evidence is arguing more and more in the favor of yes, design absolutely can. And the goal here is to try to make a safe and supportive environment as one of the steps of the processes. When there's a safe and supportive environment, the child or youth is able to create secure attachments to a nurturing adult, and the stress and trauma neurohormonal responses of overwhelm and unavailability to learn are diminished, and learning the soft non-cognitive skills of coping and ability to self-soothe and self-regulate put the child and the youth into a place of school success and feeling safer. We know what we know about trauma-informed design from the work that's been done in education, healthcare settings, homeless population services, and so forth. For trauma-informed design, dealing with buildings and educational settings, there are a few popular media examples that we can refer to. One I'd like to point out is the Inclusive Designers podcast. The host, Janet Roach, is a Design for Human Health alum, and she's moderating the panel today. She's organized this entire event, so thank you, Janet. They interviewed me because I worked on an abuse intervention center that serves children and youth, and it's called the ABC House. They are happy for you to look at their website, where you can find out more examples of that work that I did on my own website, paradigmspaces.com. This is just an example of how well a trauma-informed design approach can serve vulnerable, traumatized populations, both the children and youth and the staff and educators that serve them. Here's some really great examples of people doing trauma-informed design approach to their setting. We have all of them are serving children or families on this page. Please feel free to come back and visit this at the replay that you can get. There are some really positive things coming out of these groups. Portland Homeless Family Solutions has a TED Talk by Brandy Tuck. theory of place design is based in New York City and are serving people in Baltimore and Los Angeles. And Y2Y is a Boston-based homeless services for youth. ASID is involved, and you can see that there are a lot of people thinking through how to make trauma-informed design work for their particular population and their particular setting. It's not a cookie-cutter approach. It must be done thoughtfully, and there are means to do so. So you've decided that you do want to implement a trauma-informed design approach. You gather your team, everybody's on board, but you do want to have a little ground to stand on. So some of the evidence-based design resources that I would recommend are Healing by Design, a guide that Britta Loeb wrote, and she can be found at designinghealing.com. Bright Spaces also has a great resource, and the chapter in Supporting and Educating Traumatized Students just released second edition, edited by Eric Rosen. The chapter 19 that Dat Kopeck and I authored is Design as the Missing Variable in Trauma-Informed Schools. I would give that a thumbs up. It's very hands-on and applied. It has some theory to guide your decision-making processes as you move forward in this journey. This image is from the designs that some of the BAC students came up with for the McCormick School that you'll be hearing about shortly from Sophia. This is not how it looks currently, but in the planning stages, this was some of the ideas we had come up with. So back to your role in this movement. What can I do next? Well, you've already done step one. Which is to realize that trauma-informed design is feasible, and even the smallest changes can have measurable impacts on your health and well-being of your educators and the students involved. So go ahead and decide, make that choice, and be a leader. I would strongly recommend hiring an expert to join the team. There are trauma-informed designers, environmental psychologists, environmental designers, evidence-based designers, people with EDAC, Well AP or FitWell certifications. And remember to know and learn your ecosystem. Come at it with a blank slate if you are an ethnographer. Really get a tailored approach so that you can meet the needs of your population most optimally. And just to flash this reference page at you so you know to come back and visit if you want to, the replays will be available. And my contact information will be on the liner notes for this talk. Please get in touch with me. I'm always happy to help drive this movement forward. Trauma-informed design matters, and I'm happy to play a part in this pivotal new way of looking at our brain and our bodies and our buildings. Thank you very much. Be well.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Davis. That was terrific. I'm sorry. Things got a little wonky. Again, it's live, right? But so Mary Jo, what were your takeaways from that? What were your thoughts?
So in listening to Davis's presentation and having kind of heard Davis before, it always strikes me how much you just have to know your population, and that you can't just kind of do the reading. You have to go, you have to be part of, you have to ask questions, you have to observe, you have to ask more questions. And then the other thing that I really took away from this particular piece was it doesn't have to be huge. You can make a big difference by doing smaller things, and almost a harm reduction model, right? So that even any little bit will help, even if you're not doing the entire thing, even if you're not doing a whole school or if you're doing every single part of the building, any small piece will help with safety, will help people feel safer, and that kids learn better, as we learned from Christine, when they feel safe. So I think.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And we'll hear a little bit more from Sophie about just even small things can make a big impact. So Davis, what other kind of things do you want to emphasize? Is there something else, say, you would like for people to understand and get from your talk?
Well, listening to almost all of the talks that have happened today through the back talks, I just see that we're designing for the planet, which is a system that supports us as humans. So coming back to our most vulnerable or so-called vulnerable people, if we include them in the conversation, they're able to articulate their needs and we present to them more options for what could be. So we're reimagining now, and we must just go for it. There's no time to overanalyze and sit around and process things forever. It's a matter of let's get in conversation with the people who are not able to talk at the moment because they're not invited into the space. So I'm excited to hear what the other panelists will talk about and see how this is, it's all this interconnected web that we're all part of. And it's just very exciting to be an activist in this way versus my previous life before I became an academic. I like this way a lot. I can do really radical change from my screen. I don't necessarily have to put myself in harm's way. So thank you for facilitating, and we'll just move on to the next.
We'll keep moving forward. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Davis. And I think what we'll probably do, Eliza, if you're listening, I think we'll probably just go to Sophie. Mary Jo, do you want to tell us a little bit about Sophie?
Sure.
First?
So she's the director of Trinity at McCormick. McCormick is a school in Boston that really took on the principles of trauma-informed design to help the kids there feel safer, have better options, and more access to their education.
There she is. Hi.
Hi.
So tell us a little bit about what you're going to talk about today.
So my name is Sophia Brown Meisels. I'm the director of a program called Trinity at McCormick that does both intensive clinical services for youth in that school and also supports the school to become a trauma-informed and restorative school community. I wanted to put this slide up first just because I think if there is one takeaway, it's that we need the design and we need the action. That trauma-informed design is one part of changing a community's values and behaviors to be trauma-informed and inclusive for all young people. Our program serves a population of kids who are all youth of color. We talked about ACEs normally. We do an adjusted ACEs. And the average for our caseload is about 17 out of a 25-point ACEs scale. So all of our young people are dealing with toxic stress and complex trauma. We have a four-part trauma-informed school. What I'm going to talk about today is mostly on the slide you're seeing the self-efficacy and self-awareness. It's a really amazing place for design to come in. And a little bit about contribution. I should note before I get to the slide, I work for Trinity Boston Connects, which is a nonprofit in Boston that has multiple programs. And our core values are racial equity, trauma-informed care, and restorative justice. And I think one thing that is specific to the young people I'm going to talk about in our school is that because they are all young people of color, one of the ways in which they are being re-traumatized in school is being in an institution that espouses that it is there to support them, but in actuality, historically has been set up to disenfranchise and dehumanize most of those young people. And so I think that is really specific to them. So Christine did an amazing job with trauma. I'm going to add in one thing before we go to our program and some data, which is this slide. So a normal person's brain does these processes in the course of making a decision. They're not conscious and they're very fast. We observe, we interpret, we process, we make an evaluation based on previous experience, and we act. For a person that's in that manageable stress place, the fight, flight, freeze, or fake comes in, and our brain does a different process to make sure that we keep ourselves safe in any life-threatening situation. What happens with complex trauma is that that fight or flight pathway becomes the dominant pathway. And people who are in toxic stress for a long period of time, their brains don't remember to follow the normal pathway of interpreting, process, evaluating, and acting. And so what this means for young people is that any stress triggers a toxic stress, triggers a fight or flight response. And why that's important is that, as Christine said, in schools, kids are stressed all the time. Learning should be positive stress. But for young people dealing with toxic stress in schools, all stress feels like a fight or flight response. And that's why for people, I know there's some school psychologists, why we see things that seem to us as observers as huge overreactions to small events with young people. So the last thing before I talk about our program is that I just want to name that relationships, again, people have said this before, are critical to the work we do. Relationships are what harm us, both systemic relationships and interpersonal relationships, and they are the only thing that heals. The process in the brain that I just talked about, our brains only change by experience. So as we talk about this program, the two things that I want to point out to you is that all of the actions are about having positive relationships with other people and all of the interventions are about practice. Our brain is not, a kid's brain is not going to relearn that pathway that we want them to relearn around processing and evaluating and acting unless they are constantly practicing that process. They will not be able to change with us telling them to change. They have to be given opportunities to practice a new way of thinking and being and doing. And they're not going to be able to do that unless they're in safe and supportive relationships, like Christine talked about. The last thing about this slide that I think is important, particularly in this time to name, is that the relationships are about perception. So young people feel safe and supported in a relationship if they feel safe and supported in a relationship. There are many times as a consultant with schools where I am talking to adults who say, I have a great relationship with this kid. And the kid says, I don't have a good relationship with that adult. That's not personal, but that perception is important. And particularly for adults who are working cross difference, cross race, cross genders, cross sexual orientation or gender identification, our perception of how supportive we are to somebody may not be their perception of our support. And what matters in trauma-informed care is that the young person feels supported. So I'm going to talk a little bit about our intervention. So in 2016, we started with our caseload, a WIN room, a what I need room, that was specifically designed to help with the self-regulation skills that are lost when a young person is dealing with toxic stress. Again, that space is highly ritualized to help with this. It's consistent all day long, so kids can use it whenever they want. It's really important that the space is consistent with the adult, that if there's an adult in that space, which clinicians, the response to the kid is the same. And the goal is for the student to learn self-regulation tools that are appropriate for a school. So to practice how to cope with feelings and behaviors that they don't know how to deal with in a way that is appropriate to school. We tracked both how much students use the room and how long they needed to use the room. So in the room, part of the design was to do three components, to help kids know what they needed in a moment, to get themselves somewhere safe, to figure out how to cope, what do I need to do with my body, and then to be able to reflect on what led them to feeling whatever emotion they were feeling. And all of those three things were included in the way that we designed the space. So there are posters that reminded people of how you can cope. And I think if each of you thinks about how you cope with difficult things yourself, you'll find that they're somewhere in one of these four posters. I need to focus on something specific. I need to calm down with a meditation. I need to move my body. I need to be creative and create something. So these posters help me think about what do I need to do in the moment to help myself manage my body. The next question is, what do I need to do to feel differently? How can I change what I'm feeling in my body? So there were elliptical machines. There were chairs that were sensory deprivation. There were posters that reminded them of mindfulness activities. They were stress balls. There was painting. There was all different kinds of things included in the design of the room that helped them be able to change their internal state, how they were feeling. Next slide. And finally, there were things that helped them reflect on what happened. And this is where the relationship comes in. So they would fill out a form after they were calmed down and then go back with an adult and have the conversation. What was I feeling? What could I have done differently? And what could people around me have done differently? And how do I have a response to whatever that emotion that's helpful to me? So as you can see from our data in October, there were 79 visits from 20 kids during the month. And by June, there were 13. And the time that they were needed in the room to sort of calm down and self-regulate had a similar curve. And this is exactly what we wanted to see. So with practice, young people were able to take away that highway of toxic stress that was a fight or flight response and go back to being able to learn the skills to have more choice and efficacy over how they were reacting to things that upset them during the school day. We also got this confirmed with teachers. We took monthly teacher polls about how students were doing in the classroom. There was a 27% increase in positive coping skills and a 8% decrease in kids acting out in the classroom from teachers' reports. And finally, what we didn't really expect, but we're thrilled about, was that there was significant an increase in attendance, which is a data point that's important to high school graduation for young people, and in GPAs. 90% of the students in that caseload increased their GPA over the year as they were able to stay in class more, and the average GPA increased by 77%, which was pretty amazing, and much higher than we expected. So the last thing I'll talk about is that Ultimately, we wanted to move these spaces in. These are some pictures of called Peace Corners, which were WIN spaces in classrooms. And this has been a huge part of where the design has really helped. So different teachers have designed these based off of their own interests and their own needs and the needs of the students. And again, like Davis was saying, really bringing in the voice of each teacher and each student in the classroom. And each of these spaces have the same things that you saw in the WIN room. These are some outcomes I know are running out of time, but there were very similar positive outcomes for the WIN spaces in the rooms, for the Peace Corners in the rooms, as we saw when Trinity was running our own WIN room in the school. And it's been really successful to bring them in to the classrooms. I think the one big takeaway for me is that students are saying that they get all the benefits of a re-regulation space, but they also can follow the classroom curriculum when those re-regulation spaces are designed in the classrooms rather than a space outside of the classrooms where the students leave to go to. That's it.
Inspiring. I just love what you do. Mary Jo, what were your takeaways? Do you have any questions for Sophie?
I think there was so much there. So and it's amazing what was done, and your outcomes are really, really impressive. I guess the first thing that I would take away is that design can and should be part of treatment and not just an afterthought, but actually when you're thinking about a treatment plan, when you're thinking about actual intervention, think about the environment and make those adjustments. And the other thing is that the interplay of biology, environment, community can't be underplayed, that they're so completely connected and that you can address one, but if you don't address the other two, you're not going to get the results. And that when you do address all three, the gestalt is amazing and that you've really made an impact on the whole community. So I think it's, for me, that was what was most inspiring, was that the impact you can make and the outcomes you can get with doing just some minor tweaks are really impressive.
Right. I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, Mary Jo, but Sophie will tell you, this school has no money for what she was able to do for no money, and the outcomes that she was able to achieve. I mean, it's nothing short of a small miracle. Sophie, I really applaud what you do, and you do it every day. And I know that this hasn't been easy for you to do this. I know you would rather be with your students. So we really appreciate you coming on in. Is there any last words to give us or any kind of other ideas for design, or was there something that you felt like you needed to add? There she's back. All right, Sophie, real quick.
The design piece is a really important piece of the whole trauma-informed school, in that it's also something very concrete that schools often don't have the budget for, and that we don't think about in terms of what we're communicating to young people is their worth and to teachers. And I think the only other thing is that as we come through this pandemic, as we come through what is hopefully a revolution in terms of the way that we are valuing people of color, we're doing this as something that we're doing for all schools and assuming that every kid needs it.
Right. Again, we think that that's very clear. I think that that was one of the reasons why a lot of you signed up for this particular session. I think you all recognize it. We're not quite sure if the polls are working, so I'm not quite sure. I will assume most of you at this point will think that you'll be mentioning trauma-informed design within at least the next 6 months quite a bit. You can come back to reference it on Inclusive Designers. So maybe we'll try to see if we can't get Angela on the phone for a couple of minutes. Angela, are you around? Are you able to get back on, or how's that working?
So can I just jump in while we're waiting for Angela? One of the things I'd like to reinforce or kind of punch up that Sophie talked a little bit about and everybody before her is that when you're designing for inclusivity, it benefits everybody.
Right.
And everybody is, you don't always have to design for a particular group. If you design for inclusivity, then, if you consider trauma or disadvantaged kids, whenever you're designing anything, if you just consider that everybody can use that space, then everybody moves up and then it becomes part of the regular vernacular. And it's not just well, that's the trauma room, or that's, it becomes something that everybody can use and a skill that everyone can have.
Right. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. All right, Angela, you're up.
I know. Hello. Here I am. Okay. And thanks to Eliza, technical difficulties resolved. I came over here to make sure everything was working. So everything, I know Sophie, because when I was over at the McCormick, after being at the Boston Teachers Union as political director, she was in the office next door. So I remember her seeing about 15 students a week. Everything that we do as practitioners has to meet the legal mandate of safe and supportive schools. And that is the umbrella for everything in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And the way it was designed, and I have to give credit to Mayor Walsh, Speaker DeLeo, Senate President Karen Spilka, Senator Sal DiDomenico, Representative Ruth Balza, Senator Julian Sear, Representative Tacky Chan, and particularly the team under the direction of Susan Cole at the Trauma Learning Policy Initiative. They're really the architects, the TLPI under Susan Cole's direction, and it was 20 years in the making. So everything was designed to bring all the children together and bring partners, joint union management, public-private sector, together, so we can service children and give them the resiliency. And there's that higher legal mandate. So we talk about, we hear a lot of sound bites, social emotional learning, trauma. What does it look like? There are frameworks through the Department of Education. Everybody should take a look at it because that is our umbrella. And it really was designed. And I can say that being one of the incubator group of eight in the Boston Public Schools, along with my mother under Dr. Rhonda Goodale, where it was designed so it would be K-12, but it should be replicated at the higher education level. So everybody has a social emotional learning, bullying prevention, dropout prevention. You see that at higher ed, mental health, foster care. We see homelessness. We see hunger, LGBTQ. I always say that wrong. Race and gender, transitioning students, you know, restraint, resource officers, ELL students. I can keep going. Student voice. It was designed to have student voice. So whatever anybody does going forward, that it needs to fit that framework and pull it together, because really without the support and the policy piece that has been put in place, again, it was over 20 years in the making, and it was due to practitioners, you know, bringing all the folks together. I hear Trinity came in 2016 while the law was passed in 2014. And it was designed so everybody could come together and everybody could have a space at the table and really make life better for children, families, and our community. I remain available. Again, it's Angela Christiani. I've worn many hats. Depending upon how you know me would be how you know me. But I'm always available to help, and how it's like a puzzle. You know, you there's a puzzle. It's thrown up in the air and all those pieces fall on the ground. And how does it fit together? How is it integrated? And we want to make sure we do it right for children, because if we do it right for children, it helps the practitioners, which are the teachers. But I love what the BAC is doing going forward, because this is groundbreaking, just like the work we did on safe and supportive schools. And it really needs to happen. And the time, we have a lot of pieces. It's just how we put it together. So I'll stop there.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Angela. And thank you also for acknowledging the BAC and being in the forefront of this. This is, you know, designed for human health. This is what we do. You know, I know Davis, if we could get Davis back on, she would totally agree with me on that. And we have a great champion in somebody like Mahesh and Don Hunsicker, you know, the design studies program. It's only growing, and we are, you know, I remember really quickly, just to say, Davis and I was seeing Corey Freed, I'm not going to remember his name. He was in one of the other talks earlier today, and he was talking in terms of sustainability, but he also said the design for human health is going to be where it's at. And Davis and I dare say it was pre-pandemic, we were giving each other hugs, like, we know this is going to be big. And to Angela's point, you know, and looking at trauma informed, especially within the education system, is going to be so important, getting kids back to school. When they go back, to be determined. How they go back, to be determined. But this component will be a very important part. Maybe Davis, you could talk to us a little bit how you see some of the takeaways that we can share with the audience.
Well, I mean, I see a lot in the chat box about how to make this happen in your setting. And so that to me is just resoundingly positive. There isn't a set guideline, because the trauma-informed design is in its not even infancy. It's still a couple of days old. Trauma-informed care practices and policies are a newborn. I was at the Trauma-Informed Oregon steering committee yesterday, and they say, look, we were formed in 2014. The same year as Design for Human Health was formed. So these are things that we are helping to shape. And so the conversations that we can get going and the relationships we can have between each other, I think, is part of the key to making this work. And recognizing once you know it, you can't unknow it. So understanding that the environment will have an impact on the functioning of the people who are in that space, not just the children and the youth, of course the children and the youth, but the adults and staff that care for those people, everybody is caring for each other. So, and how we do our own self-care is certainly part of the story. So how we are able to let ourselves perceive that we have some power and agency without necessarily running the show. We don't have to run it all. It's not our business to run it all. But what can you do within your own means, starting with, is there a way to lower blinds? If the afternoon sun is coming into a classroom setting and the children are getting light in their eyes, we know from Alzheimer's and dementias, folks, that's when sundowning occurs because you're getting a bright glare. And this is really disruptive to the ability to stay calm. So there's a lot that we do know, and we are really looking for ways to put it forward into very tangible and meaningful ways that people can just take it and run with it, because we are all immediate. We want it to be ready to go right now, but it's an ongoing conversation.
Right. Absolutely. You know, I'm trying to figure out if there's any questions. So I do see one question, and I thought we would maybe try to answer it. How can we use psychology to improve our designs for general positive well-being beyond the interiors, but the building itself, especially COVID and with isolation? Let me try to break it down a little bit further. Are there other ways that we can go and look at the built environment? I mean, Sophie brought up some really good ideas, and they're not that expensive, right? I also saw that she was just posting that a lot of the class, they got a grant, and a lot of the classrooms only had like $400 to put in some of these piece corners and stuff like that, and the painting and to help kids to self-regulate. Any other ideas that you guys have?
Could I jump in, it's Angela?
Absolutely, yeah.
I would suggest, so first of all, I'll speak to the city of Boston. You know, we have all these agencies and all these partners that come in. So as practitioners, school psychologists have the lead in the schools. There aren't enough of them, but that's a different issue. Okay, that's a budgetary issue. But one way to start fixing things is a collaboration with the school-based people and the outside folks and the agencies. So the partnership is everything. And the one thing that I can honestly say is the mayor in the city of Boston, Mayor Walsh, has unconditionally funded schools. It's the largest budget, I believe, in the city. And without question, any ask I can say on a policy level and on a political level, he has respected. And he cares greatly for the children and the teachers and wants to make the lives better for the children. So if the money doesn't appear to be there, and I was at the McCormick, I know that we hear it's a poor school. There's money in that school. I can say that, having developed funds and done fundraising, there is money in that school. It might not be packaged the same way as it is at other schools. So getting everybody at the same table is where you really begin. And again, meeting the higher law, which is safe and supportive schools, because right now we have everything in silos. Bringing everybody together, because everybody's heart is in the right place, and making it work, and working toward the standards through the Department of Ed, and then bringing the architects, bringing the policymakers, bringing everybody together, bringing Trinity. I mean, they're a partner of ours in the city and others, and having everybody's trying to do the same thing and kind of getting us all rowing in the same direction.
To your point, I mean, that's always a great way to approach design anyways. You want all the stakeholders to be there. You want the teachers to be there. You want to go and also interview students.
Yep.
And you want to go and observe. You know, yep. Mary Jo, you brought that all in before. Yep. That is all important points to remember. You know, you're not doing this in some sort of vacuum. You're not looking at a room and going, okay, we're going to go and design, and it's going to be a pretty little wall over here. Right. I mean, let's talk about what they're looking at. And so at the Design for Human Health program, what we looked at is the biology, psychology, and sociology of a space. So, I mean, and then also in the world of COVID, you know, how do we keep kids literally safe? Also, what is the biology behind the trauma? Those are two examples. And the psychology would also be along the same lines. What are the traumas that are creating, as to Sophie's point, the fight, flight, or faint? And wait, there's four of them now, right? They change every day. Fight, flight, faint, and freeze. And then what I think is really kind of interesting, it's kind of glossed over sometimes, is the sociology component of it. So what about people's cultures? What about their religion? What about their background, their home life, that kind of stuff? All needs to be kind of put in with that soup, if you will. So can we get either Davis, is Sophia Davis or Christine back on?
So while we're doing that, can I just say that using the policy, like Angela had said, what use the policy, use the research. So pull in research, pull in policy, because that is your backbone. That's the backbone of being able to then structure things around and know what the policies are and know what best practices are through research. That does actually give you a leg to stand on if you're going to a school board or if you're going to a
plant
or something. Absolutely do that.
Yeah. Right. And to Davis's talk, I mean, looking at the evidence is so important, because you can, to your point, Mary Jo, you can point to it and be like, this is what the evidence is showing us. And it's not, I'm not just putting the stairway here because it looks pretty. So we look at all those different components, again, the biology, psychology, and sociology of space, but we take the evidence that's out there and try to implement it. Anything you'd like to add with that, Davis? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm learning more and more about how firms are including somebody who is an evidence-based designer or research informed practitioner in their firms. So the more I hear about that, the more I think, okay, good. We're starting to see a shift in how people can create evidence-based design research that will have impacts. But as you can imagine, as Mary Jo said the word gestalt earlier, and that is one of the theories that means, well, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So when you consider an interior, you have so many different design variables that it can be very difficult to measure how that space is impacting somebody. I worked quite a bit with preschool children and looked at how the presence of randomized houseplants might affect their attention abilities. And this is just one variable I was shifting. Some days the plants were there, some days the plants were not. How did that change how they behaved during the set time of going and looking at which free choice area did they want to go play in? But you know, if you're starting to measure both the ceiling height and the wall colors, well, was it the ceiling height or the wall colors that had the impact on somebody's pro-social behavior? This is where, you know, knowing that there's many of us working on this, it isn't just up to me to figure this out. I would be completely overwhelmed. And to know that there's others who are doing this work, hundreds of people are involved with the Environmental Design Research Association. IAPS is the International Association of People and Spaces. These are folks who want to bring design to research and vice versa, so that we can make the world a safe place for everybody.
Absolutely.
Having spaces that are safe and supportive. And it's I never come to work. This is all just, I love it so much. So
right. It's right on.
An honor to know you all and to see such a great chatty bunch on the chats. If people want to answer the polls, give the panelists and myself some great information. So take a minute and go answer those polls, because then we can kind of use a little bit of soft research.
Yeah. Okay. Terrific. Because I see something, and actually, Davis, it's from you, and you're talking about sensory paths as another option for design. And can you talk a little bit about that? Because I always find wayfinding and sensory paths to be kind of fascinating.
We're here to interpret, right? I mean, everything around us, physical, is a vibration. So we're trying to interpret the world and make sense of it. That's our job as humans. So people have different abilities to process. Some have hyper stimulation to noises, while they have an under aroused tactile components. So they might need a deep pressure situation where they're getting ability to hug each other a lot, or squeeze the squishies, or be able to use fidget material. So this is satisfying some part of them that can create a self-soothing. So once they're able to self-soothe, then they can get into the neurohormonal situation where they're reducing their cortisol levels and they're able to be calm and get into a receptive learning mode. It's a fun journey because it is this sculpture, this sort of a puzzle of, well, what will work for some won't work for others. So it's clearly something that having a team of people who are trained in this and understand this can help you check your thoughts. Of course, it all starts with your own self. You need to check yourself and know where you come from, who you are as a designer, or as a school psychologist, or as a learner, as a mom, as a whomever it is. It's something that if sensory issues get out of control, then misbehavior happens. I mean, I speak from personal experience with my 10-year-old. So this has been a well-adjusted, nice, safe house, white privilege. We're good. Everything's cozy in our world. And yet she's displaying a lot of, I'm getting traumatized because of this ongoing uncertainty and lack of socialization. So hopefully that touches on just some of it. And we understand that this whole talk is a two-year degree or longer. So we're doing the best we can without overwhelming everybody. Just give you a touch of what there is in the trauma-informed design world.
Right. A little taste. And it's interesting. So Christine actually just put something in there. It's about experiencing maybe like hyper arousal. And Christine, if you can jump in at some point. You know, it's the idea that, you know, we have this ability, you know, we can use breath work or physical activity. Is there anything else that you would like to add to that?
There are lots of things that are available to help ground a person. So the number one thing I like to do when someone is over the top, like in the hyper arousal area, feeling anxious, because that's what we see more often, or at least we feel more acutely than the hypo arousal.
Right. Wouldn't you also maybe suggest that, I mean, a lot of us are in that hyperarousal. I mean, we are all experiencing trauma right now. Right. I mean, I swear to God, I think I had a small panic attack at Hannaford's the other day.
So the number one thing you could use at home on yourself or with someone else is a countdown technique. You start with five things you can see and say them aloud. Find them and say them. Four things you can feel, three things you can hear, two things you can smell, and one thing you can taste. And by the time you get to the taste, you'd be surprised how much more calm you are, especially because, I mean, it's really what's on the inside of your mouth. So that's really bringing you into your body. And usually, you know, hopefully when you're thinking about all these different things, when you're thinking about what you can see, it's what's around you. But when you're thinking about what you can feel, it's about how your body is interacting with all of that around you. What you hear, what you smell. I mean, hopefully some of that is you're hearing your breath and you're really focusing on how you're interacting with your surface. You know, I like for the thing I can feel, it might be touching this desk where my feet and how they're touching the floor in my shoes and all those kinds of things. It's amazing how quickly that can slow you down and really focus you.
Right. Mary Jo, do you have any design ideas and how to achieve some of those great tactics?
Well, I think it's knowing the environment and knowing the person, because you know, kind of as we talked about before, everybody's going to have a little bit of a different path. You know, their sensory thing's going to be a little bit different. And so I think it's knowing your environment and knowing where those sort of quieter spaces are. If you can help talk to somebody, or even if just yourself, kind of plant yourself somewhere and just help, if you know, then start there and kind of just do some prompting as opposed to go do that and go do, you know, you want to help someone along, but you want to stay really calm. You want the environment to be as calm as possible. Once people get used to doing this, you could be on a crazy busy train and you can just take a deep breath and you can just start doing it yourself. And you know, it's really quick. It's like guided imagery or something. Once you get practiced at it, the environment becomes a little less important around being able to get in touch with yourself and be able to bring your blood pressure down. But yeah, I think that environment needs to be, and the built environment needs to be thoughtful, not just pretty.
Right, absolutely. And that's sort of what we're here. Christine, I'll let you, we're running out of time. So
one last thing, the number one thing when someone is under distress is to help them feel safe. And that might take some trial and error in asking them what they need. But as soon as they feel safe, you'll start to see it come down a little bit. And then you'll be able to have more of those conversations about other things that they might need or want. But safety is key.
Terrific. Thank you, Christine. Davis, do you have any kind of last minute? You got like 1 minute. Any thoughts?
Really appreciative everybody took the time to come and join today. That to me makes all the difference. If we can't get folks knowing about this, then no change can happen. So I think we've really succeeded in being able to articulate, despite a few tech difficulties, how strongly this matters and how easily it can happen. It can happen on the micro scale in your school. It can happen at any age, K through 12, higher ed. Any space can be improved by trauma-informed design. Absolutely.
Right. Thank you, Davis. Mary Jo, any last second? You got like...
Yes. Anything is better than nothing. Just give it some thought and take a stab at it.
Right. Thank you very much, guys. Mary Jo Cooper, terrific. Thank you so much. Dr. Hart, as I always end up calling her. Lovely. Sophie, I'm going to say your name is going to be terrible because I'm running out of time. I can feel it. And then Angela Christiani, thank you so much. Don't forget, it's Inclusive Designers. Podcast is inclusivedesigners.com. And we'll have all that information on there. And this has all been recorded. Thank you so much. I'm Janet Roach. And on behalf of the Design for Human Health program, thank you so much for listening on today's talk about trauma-informed design. Thank you.